It is Saturday, December 6th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. And ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind that the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch in the host chair today, and with me in the studio is Lyle Troxell, back from Europe. He's a photographer, software engineer, and father.
Hello.
Hello. And Miles Elam, software engineer and political junkie.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, lots of stuff to talk about, some good news, some bum outs. And I'm just going to, let me just say right off the bat that it's been kind of a tough week for me. Every time I turn on the news, I'm punished for doing so. It's kind of bleak out there, guys.
It does feel that way a little bit, doesn't it?
It does feel that way. So, just a note that when things are rough, it's a good time to try and be a little kinder to each other because we could all use it. Man, oh, man.
You know, I'm a little concerned about Miles' mic. Miles, can you say hi again?
Hi.
No, I can't hear you through that mic. That mic is... So you guys, cycle mics.
All right, here we
Throw a mic over. Yeah, we hear the wonderful sounds. Professional.
There we go.
Oh, that feels much better. Okay, good. Hey, Miles, you've been looking into sites that tout themselves as being secure and have discovered that other people are doing the same thing and finding disturbing information.
Although I don't feel so bad about, I feel bad about the insecure sites, but in general, they're not the problem, I think. It's the third parties that are providing these seals, like the seal of approval, security. You know, I'm sure we've all seen this. Go to a site, you see something that looks like a medieval shield.
The little image that's on the page itself.
Yeah, the various badges that show up.
I've always thought, as a web developer, I always thought those were the stupidest things in the world.
And why is that?
Because an image like that can be copied from any site that you see it, and then you can just place it on your own site. So there's there's nothing there that tells you anything. And then, of course, presumably you could click on it and it would take you to the other site, and then the site would say, congratulations, this is really good. This is a good service, which is an advertising from the company that gave you the seal in the first place. So
it's like
even
making
when it's
it
valid,
into who's who or something.
It's ridiculous.
So as it turns out,
yes,
the companies that are providing these seals, maybe it's not really worth the money you're paying them. Because
Your suspicions might be correct.
Because when researchers were taking an audit of a lot of these sites that had these seals on them, these badges, they found that they had worse security than average. They are more vulnerable to hacking than most other sites.
Oh, so it's like a shield washing. What?
Well, it's I like to think of it in terms of it's a marketing thing.
Uh-huh.
And if you have people in charge of a site that are not as technically oriented, or rather not so much in charge of the site but in charge of the company, that are not as technically oriented, for them it's like they see the badge and they're like, oh, see, that looks like it's good. I can, and someone gives them a pitch and they go, yeah, that seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
And in general, if you have someone at the top who is technically not astute, it tends to trickle down and they've spent less money and less budget on other things. So the people who are actually building the site will make a page that isn't quite up to snuff or doesn't quite have that that security level. And the companies that do have a good security level, they're too busy locking down the site to put badges
right
up.
Okay. Okay. So because it's really not a security feature, these badges. Now, when we're talking about this, we're not talking about in the browser bar. In the browser, there's basically two types of certificates you can get. These are the important parts.
Yeah.
And this is a domain verified certificate, which just means, hey, the person that owns the domain has the right certificate. Most likely.
Right.
And
that's
the other one,
that's where you enter in the URL for the site.
And then that's the ones that do not show up green. The websites that are secure but don't show up green. And then there's extended validation. Extended validation is a certificate where the provider of the certificate, the signing authority, actually checked to see if that company exists, it's a real company, and that real company actually has a certificate. So they have to make a phone call. It's a more expensive certificate. So those things are great. But after that, on the page itself is what we're talking about on these
right
badges. They just don't actually add any validity. And it makes sense that if you're spending more money there, which is basically a marketing technique, then you're not spending money on the security. In mass. I mean, I would say that sometimes it might be totally secure. But yeah, these badges
don't
pay for it.
If you really have invested in making your site secure, you already know that these badges are useless.
Right.
So chances are, if you do see the badges, there's...
I love it. I love that idea.
Basically, we don't need no stinking badges.
That's right. Good summary. Absolutely.
All right. Duly noted. The judges have ruled on the Target credit card hack.
Yeah, so we've been covering this Target hack for quite a while. In fact, the first time we talked about it was on an episode of Geek Speak, January 18th, 2014. Mm. The title of that show is called Fish Eats Floppy Phone on Mac's 30th Anniversary. But we talked about the first look at the Target intrusion.
Okay.
And this was a situation in which hackers went ahead and got to a point-of-sale terminal in one of the Target's company stores and inserted a virus. And that virus, between mid-November of 2013 and mid-December of 2013, collected user data and sent it off to the people that were running the system.
Yeah, although not limited to one store.
No, it spread.
Propagated to their...
It was a popular option.
Yeah. A total of 40 million customers' credit cards as well as 70 million customer information got stolen by this breach. Mm-hmm. So now a district court judge...
Which meant that...
Yes.
Banks had to reissue credit cards and do a lot of fol-de-rol.
Additionally, if any of those cards were used in some transaction, there was a lot of question whether the transaction was valid. And as we know in the U.S., credit card companies basically consume the cost of any fraud. Mm-hmm. So if you have a credit card charge on your bill, mm-hmm. it's not really you. And especially if there's a situation where it was easy for someone to steal something, you just call the bank and say, I'm sorry, I didn't buy sneakers in Nebraska.
And absorb it.
And then the credit card company absorbs it. Okay. So this could cost the credit card companies a lot of money.
A lot of money, particularly when several big box stores got hit in this way. That means the banks had to scramble a lot spend a lot of money.
And so a district court on Tuesday, a judge in Minnesota, a district court judge, said that, yeah, you know what? You can sue them for this. You can sue Target for this, credit card companies, because clearly they didn't react when they could have. And the basic failed to heed warning signs is the thing there. And that's one of the things where we were shocked by, that they kind of knew for a while there might be a problem. Target did.
Target knew for a while there might be a problem.
Well, could have known. Could have been better
could
about
have
it.
Known.
Therefore, they're okay. Therefore,
the
they weren't doing a good
job.
Information
was available for them to put together.
Yeah.
So that's an instance of a court making a good decision about whether somebody could proceed and start
and sue
a case.
Them. And the thing that's also interesting is that this was a joint case with credit card companies and consumers. So credit card companies and consumers actually joined forces on something, which
Whoa.
I think is probably historical.
That might be, yeah. May it be a force for good in the world ever after.
So if this actually succeeds, you could see this happen in other states as well. This was in Minnesota, but you could see it happen all over the place.
So this is Minnesota specific.
And the cost is claimed to be about $400 million on just replacing the credit cards when this breach occurred. Mm-hmm. So $400 million is what's at stake to some degree in this. All right.
So that's a legal step that happens. You ask, hey, is this even allowed, this kind of a suit? And in this case, the judges said, yes. We've had a couple of instances of, I'm just going to bring up grand juries, making a decision that said, no, do not proceed with indicting.
Right.
Now, I'm not sure. I'm sure, you know, legal folks might have an issue with me putting a link between those two things, but I got to make a segue somehow.
Okay, good segue.
But folks who aren't lawyers, there's a common misconception that the grand jury is like a court, only more so, and it's not. It's just the initial, is there probable cause for a case? Should a trial even be conducted? And it's a very narrow standard.
And there's a lot I do not understand about how grand juries work, and perhaps what's been happening will shed more light for people in general on what that body is and what it does.
The general concept of grand jury, though, is you get together a whole bunch of people, you get a jury, and then they hear a whole bunch of potential cases and say,
Go ahead and indict.
So it's like it's an ongoing process where they look at multiple cases. That's from what I understand.
Yes, and usually very quickly, and don't spend weeks and weeks analyzing.
And so the people that are involved at that point would be prosecutors kind of showing what the potential case could look like, mm-hmm. and who might be involved, and kind of a skeleton output. But it's not a deep dive because it's actually not judging validity. I mean, it's not judging guilt. It's just judging whether we should look at judging guilt.
Right. Defense attorneys are not there.
Right.
And you're not taking depositions. It's just,
yeah.
hey, we have this evidence and we want to go to trial.
Right.
So what's interesting is what evidence gets brought in and what evidence does not get brought in, and how that evidence is weighted.
Or how it's perceived by the jurors.
By mm-hmm. the jurors. And you've got a beef about that, Miles.
Yes. For example, video coverage of the police, you know, choking a man in Staten Island. This is obviously emotionally charged, and it does it is a personal beef with many of us on the show.
And we talked a lot about whether we wanted to talk about this on air because whether it was geeky
enough.
We had
a real discussion about it, and I shed my tears beforehand and we'll be okay.
Right, but the
truth is it's something we need to be
right. The reason
about.
I'm bringing it up is because one of the things that is common in grand juries and court cases, TV has this all the time where you have do you see the person who did this crime in the courtroom? Yes, it's that eyewitness mm-hmm. testimony. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, one of the reasons why we have this eyewitness testimony, and then you have, you know, multiple people who are eyewitnesses and you get all of their stories, is because in many cases we have this Rashomon style of of dealing with a crime, because the people who are judging it were not at the crime. Mm-hmm. So you have to get all the different points of view to try to cobble together what is the truth.
Which often can contradict each other.
Right. And so with those contradictions, you try to figure out where the biases mm-hmm. Biases are.
And where the truth might lie.
Now, this changes a bit when you have video. Because video, while there can be some sense of bias with regard to the vantage point of where the camera sure. is, things like that, it's nowhere on the scale of human perception. Mm-hmm. It very much is.
Meaning that you trust a video's accuracy of reality versus a human's testimony of reality.
Yes, yeah, yes. And you take a video, and when you play that back, mm-hmm. essentially all of us became witnesses to the events in Staten Island. And so that's what I wonder about with regard to the courts and technology. And it's not just like our legal system. It's about the people who are interpreting our legal system, the jurors themselves.
Well, and specifically in the case in New York, you had video that clearly showed what happened. And I think a part of what has so much outrage about this particular decision is that everyone sees the video and then does not understand how that leads to, nah, we don't need to indict that officer.
Oh, yeah. Although not everyone, I've actually come across folks that are saying, like,
doing his job.
Yeah, the cops yeah. were doing. You have to give them some latitude. Yeah, I actually
you don't agree.
I don't.
With that.
I don't subscribe to that belief. At the same time, I think of the pushes that we've done on this show to say yes, all cops should have video cameras on them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think of the money that's been put forth by the Obama administration to make video funds available for buying video cameras. And at the same time, there seems to be a break at meat space,
yeah.
you know, at the human level, to say that the testimony of someone at a location where an event occurred, where they are describing the same things that happened that were captured on video. They're not talking about mm-hmm. things that happened off the camera's view,
right.
which is important. If someone says like something like this happened just off out of frame, mm-hmm. that's important. But if you're describing something that's in frame, there is no way that human memory and testimony should trump a video. That just seems
so
insane
to me. And this is one of the things that one of the takes I want to take on from a geeky perspective to kind of reinforce this weakness, fragility of human memory that we've talked about many times on Geek Speak, because it's one of those things that's kind of interesting, technically, that the human mind, though you can recall something and therefore have an idea of what happened, that memory is actually not very reliable to what the truth is. And in fact, in most cases where you say, hey, how reliable do you think this memory is? The more a person thinks their memory is reliable, the less likely it actually is. So there's this system that builds up a memory that's false from reality.
Right.
That the
that
more
has,
you
like,
think
a
of it,
truth shield on it,
the
so
more
you
put truth on it, the more it's most likely not true. And this yeah. is just has to do with how the brain works and how we cope with a very flexible system inside a reality system. But the courts have always had to do this, right? They've always had to rely on testimony, use testimony, and then have safeguards in the system to potentially remove that. Like, okay, let's have the people that are judging the case not be people that witnessed it. They'll hear the people that witness it. Then they'll see if there's a possibility the person that was witnessing it was wrong, and therefore, so there's like this counter system that goes, well, you have to be really sure if you prosecute for like death penalty or something. You have to be extremely sure. If you have any reasonable doubt, doubt it. Even if a testimony is something saying it absolutely happened this way. So there is a system in the courts that is old, an old tradition, to kind of try to counter this memory fragility problem. But now that we have like physical evidence that's doesn't have to do with human memory. It doesn't have the fragility of that form. There seems like we have to change the court system. We have to flip this a bit.
That and change the perceptions of general public, which are the
about
ones that,
are
serving, on juries, to say like there is something called the misinformation effect. And we're going to put up a link. We're putting up a link on the show.
At geekspeak.org.
Yeah, at geekspeak.org. That will go over some quick information about it just so you know what it is, and also the biases that we have, where if we believe something, if we are threatened with facts that contradict that belief, we more strongly hold to that belief. It's a human endeavor. It happens to all of us. It's just that in the case of these criminal cases, that belief isn't just a just a benign blind spot. It's
right.
Far from benign,
yeah.
And we need to address it.
Of course, I can already hear people countering with, yes, but video is doctorable. And that is, a fascinating topic of conversation also.
But not relevant in what we're talking about right here,
not
because most of the time doesn't happen.
Right. So that's a separate conversation. And Robert Pauly has already had it with Errol Morris. You can check it out at the Seventh Avenue Project. And we'll talk about what Robert's going to talk about tomorrow on the Seventh Avenue Project when we come back. This is Geek Speak on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Primsch with Lyle Troxell and Miles Elam. And as you know, we are big fans of the Seventh Avenue Project, another great show here at KUSP. Tomorrow on the show, men. What are they good for? Well, I have some ideas. So does Laura Kipnis. She's one of our sharpest social critics, writing incisively on topics like porn, feminism, love, and marriage. Her latest book, she tackles another big challenging subject. She talks to KUSP's Robert Pauly about her essay collection, Men, Notes from an Ongoing Investigation. You can hear that on the 7th Avenue Project, which is Thinking Persons Radio with Robert Pauly. And that's tomorrow at noon on KUSP. You can also check out his website at 7thAvenueProject.com. It is Geek Speak here on KUSP. Lots to talk about. And Lyle, you want to talk about the app of the week? You were playing around with us just before the show and we're giggling.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun little app. The app is called Photomath. It's available for free on App Store, Apple Store. I'm not sure if it's available for free on Android. But what this little app does is it takes a photograph or real-time photograph of text that is a math equation and it has to be typed. So you take a math equation, you have it typed on a piece of paper, and you want to solve it. You take the scanner, you scan the thing, it turns it back into numbers and the calculation, and then it solves it for you, gives you the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, you can actually say, show me the steps, and it will actually show you the different steps of the equation. So it's the perfect application for cheating at math homework.
Exactly. No one ever has to do their math homework ever
again.
Long as you have this app. Is that what it's for? Is it for cheating? Is that why it was designed?
No. I mean, the reason it's... I mean, I don't know.
Why?
It's about artificial intelligence getting better, right? And
okay.
We can do this.
All right.
And...
It's only cheating in the sense of, for example, when people said that calculators were cheating.
Mm-hmm.
In certain circumstances, they can absolutely be used for cheating, but they're also a convenience thing. It'd be nice to be able to point your camera at something and have it solve the problem.
Sure, especially if I'm doing my math homework or I'm in a test. Well, I mean, for what other application?
Well, already smartphones are not allowed in most classrooms during a test.
Okay, all right.
Because they do have calculators, even graphing calculators available to them.
Okay. So it's just for math homework.
So this thing can take, it can take basic arithmetic, fractions, decimal numbers, linear equations, and several functions like logarithms and handle them.
Okay.
So the basic stuff that you're traditional calculator can do, you wouldn't technically have to type it into the calculator to solve it, right? You could just have it take a picture of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that's actually it's kind of a useful feature. I wish it was kind of associated with a calculator because then you could say, I've entered this in. Am I entering in what, you'd learn how to use the calculator because, of course,
right.
In a calculator, when somebody writes something based on what the calculator needs, the way you put it in the calculator might mean a different equation. So there's something there. It's kind of interesting.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
What is interesting also, though, is that we have a lot of technology for doing OCR, optical character recognition, being able to parse a sentence and figure out its meaning. This is one of
I thought you might get to that, Miles. Yeah, exactly.
Right. How Google Translate works, for example, even though there's a lot of mistakes made, for example, with the translation, if you're doing something like a word problem, being able to parse out those individual pieces and then turn them into an equation and solve it with exactly this method that we are seeing here is not a big cognitive leap. It's not a big technological leap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it is an interesting thing to be able to say, here's my problem, take a photo of the sentence.
The sentence, yeah. Now, this app doesn't do the sentence. It just does numbers.
Right. But, I mean, I'm talking about this,
it could move forward
the logical
direction. So the thing that's interesting about this app, you should definitely give it a shot. It doesn't do a handwriting recognition because, of course, that's a little trickier as well. This is really just type stuff, so the character set has to be more simple. Probably has to be a sans serif font. I didn't try with a serif font, but a sans serif font is a pretty simple thing to read.
That's without all the extra little fancy
terms. Yeah. And it can handle, it can't really handle variables as much with algebra. So, like, an X will get turned into a multiplication instead, so it won't understand that. Okay. So some weaknesses around it, but this is the first app of this kind that I've seen on the phone, and I definitely am I don't know if I should show my son this thing because the show your work response in it is
gosh.
So good. It breaks down the equation into all the different steps. Yeah. All you have to do is copy that to your homework. You'd be done.
What a time saver.
Now, I have to say, though,
and brain saver.
I'm back and forth on like how this kind of thing is going to be a part of everyday life, right? Mm-hmm. I recall at one point in my life going, well, I was in the place where at one point in math I could start using calculators and that was fine. I thought, well, that's crazy. You're not learning math if you're using a calculator.
Right.
But now that I understand the complexity of math, having tools at your disposal that do this kind of thing make a lot of sense.
You want to spend your time on
By the time you're able to do that, you should have learned what the calculator does.
Right. And I can, I can parse through something slowly, but tell you, if I do two-digit numbers and I want to multiply them, I use a calculator.
Yeah.
I have them at my disposal all the time anyway. Google does calculating for you if
That's
you
true.
Want.
Yeah.
So I can see that though I have trepidation, I can see that this will be just a standard thing at some point. All calculators, if you will be able to do this.
It's for people who have already learned what math does.
Or it gives you another power of computation at your disposal that happens to be in a handheld thing that just allows you to think at a higher level.
It's possibly. For the real mathematicians.
Thinking, But prior to the 70s, you didn't really have handheld electronic calculators. And so before then, there was no issue of it. You go to a classroom and it's like you have to get it done.
And the
danger was, were you cheating off of the person next to you?
Right.
Then calculators were invented.
But there are also slide rulers.
Yes.
Okay, so go on. Then calculators were invented.
Then calculators, handheld calculators were made. It's a lot harder to do a slide rule on the sly in
a class. Okay.
But with these handheld calculators, schools had to change and classrooms had to change to say, okay, there's this technology in there. We need to watch for that. There is never the option to say, I don't like this, the way this technology is shaping up. Let's just stop it.
Right.
That's never going to happen.
Works, yeah.
We have to adapt to it. So now that this is out there, we have that knowledge that it is out there. And so now we need to think of creative ways of incorporating it into our lives where people still learn the appropriate math. But we're not, still.
I got to say that I tend to look at the human species as a species enhanced by technology. And so.
Cyborgs.
Well, no. I mean,
why
just
not?
Because I have a computer on my face. Yeah. I'm not talking about like necessarily embedding stuff, but the way that I function in the world, I use my phone and I use internet services to do things. And the world that I live in has a complexity level that kind of matches that need. Right, I can check quickly that my bank account and the transfers and all this stuff happened, and things are being moved. My money's being moved around in a different way now, and therefore the tool of being able to check my bank account on my phone is something that I actually rely on at this point.
Yeah.
And so the world that you live in scopes what you use. So having kids this will be a tool that everybody uses in some future date, and therefore it won't be as necessary to parse calculations by hand. Maybe. I have difficulty in that last statement, by the way.
I have an idea. Let's all just stick around and see what happens.
I'm up for that.
A philosophical discussion that you brought up with this that I want to talk about, which is what makes someone a cyborg. And you were talking about embedding, like embedding to your person. And yet, how often do you walk around – careful with your answer here. How often do you walk around in public without your clothes on?
I don't.
They are a part of you. And so having your phone being put into a pocket, which is always with you,
yeah.
How is that different from you have something that is embedded into your skin that you can detach?
Right. And let's say the phone that I don't hold one day, I don't carry it with me one day because it's not part of me in that sense that it could not be with me, is maybe akin to me having a really bad cold and not being able to think well. Right. It's my normal state is to be clothed and have a phone on me that has internet connection. That's mm-hmm. Lyle. Right. So if you one day don't have one of those features, you're not exactly the human being that you normally are. Mm-hmm. And that is
that
cybernetic
explains
in some sense.
Yeah. With the power outages up in the mountains the past couple of nights.
Oh, I've loved it. I've had light candles on. It was great.
So
I know one young person
is
very grumpy not
you know
to
what?
Have internet
when
yesterday.
When I had no power at home and no network at home,
yeah.
I still had my phone,
yeah.
And I have a new iPhone 6 Plus, which has really good battery power. And so I was surfing the net and watching Netflix videos and stuff.
Cell towers
cell towers are still up. So my whole family were like totally out. The candles are on. We're watching videos from the internet.
You can't get away.
It is amazing how much more in civilization I feel having moved to Felton.
Yeah, you didn't lose power this last week?
No, it went out, you know, for a couple of minutes.
Well, the house you used to live in on my property still had power the entire time, so you wouldn't have been out of power at my place anyway. Okay. Should we move on, Bonnie?
Let's move on. Speaking of cyborgs, yeah. Why don't we just skip the whole human meat part and go straight to artificial intelligence?
So, I mean, this definitely ties in with this math equation thing, right? You know, everyone knows what Siri is, right? Because it's got great support from Apple. People talk about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And Siri, of course, is this like digital assistant. You might not know that Google has one too. It's called Google Plus. You can do the same types of things.
Google Plus?
I'm sorry.
You
Google,
might not know. Come on.
Google, is it Google? No, it's Google Now. Excuse
Google
me.
Now.
Google
okay.
Now. I mean, the thing is, it's hard to know because the interface to get access to these different features are always just Google. And so, yeah, Google Now is the actual service that you can ask questions to, and it's very much like Siri, and it will try to parse things out.
Yeah.
It also, Google Now also has a feature where it inspects your Google email account and tries to figure out when flights might be happening, when you might have gotten a confirmation on a flight, and it powers my cybernetic computer on my face. So in any case, Microsoft doesn't want to be left behind, and Microsoft has a pre-release of Cortana. Mm-hmm. It's part of Windows 10, and Cortana is going to be a personal digital assistant. Now, these things are artificial intelligences, right? I mean, they don't have necessarily sentience. I don't know if sentience is actually really that important for an artificial intelligence.
They're just good at noticing, like getting cues from what you're saying to decide what information is you're looking for.
It's definitely
to guess.
It's definitely artificial intelligence space. It's just that most of the time when people think about artificial intelligence, they start thinking about The Matrix or Terminator, and then people start talking about the world being taken
the
over
singularity.
By...
singularity.
Yeah, yeah. Not something I'm talking about. I'm talking about artificial intelligence slowly helping our world. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Miles, you work...
I ask for something, and then it gives me the answer.
Right.
Or it notices, in the case of Google Now, for example, and more companies are doing a similar thing, where it notices the patterns that you do. Like,
right.
On this day, this person goes from this location to that location, and then goes to this restaurant at this time. So I'm learning this pattern of, oh, they're probably going from home to work and they're eating at,
right.
You know, and they're going to lunch.
An example of this is every day I take a shuttle back from home, right? And therefore the shuttle drives me on this certain road on Highway 17 in this area. And therefore every day that is at 5:15, except on Fridays it's at 4:30. So 10 minutes before 5:15 and 10 minutes before 4:30, I get an alert from Google Chrome that shows me the traffic on that route. I never set that up. I didn't do anything like that. All I did was move mm-hmm. my location regularly. And I think that's the kind of thing
it's
you're talking about.
Right.
Inspecting
service.
Yeah. And if that's not artificial intelligence, I don't know what it is. Like, that's artificial intelligence. So the question I have, the thing that's interesting is that all the three big boys are doing this, right?
Mm-hmm,
Facebook
mm-hmm.
probably has a lot of this kind of stuff as well. But the big companies providing service, Apple, Google, and Microsoft, are building these things into their products directly. They're getting better all the time. They're going to learn from each other. And mm-hmm. just years ago, the idea of having a computer do what you asked was crazy.
Yeah.
And it's been tried lots of times. And now people are just doing it all the time. It's not perfect, but it's getting better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a stepping stone to having machines just do a lot more for you.
Do they? What I want to know is for each of the voice talents that they use to feed this stuff, do they have them all say, "I'm sorry, I can't do that for you, Dave"?
I think it's a mandatory thing. You've got to reference 2001.
And do they have to sing Daisy Dave?
Well, actually, Android devices do say, "I'm sorry, I didn't catch that."
Okay.
They do say something similar.
I'm sorry, but yeah.
Anyway, this is in a Cortana is in a Windows beta, and there's videos of it. I'll link to it from.
They're already advertising it like it's a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a beta thing.
Well, yeah, it's a beta thing.
Yeah, okay. they're anticipating when the service could anticipate.
The thing that's great about these is the context it gives you. Like one of the examples in this video is, please remind me to remind you to tell me to do this. It's like, wait, what?
Oh, my
brain. And then, so the system responds with, I will remind you to remind me to do this. So the point is that the description that's at the target of that is not something that can actually be parsed necessarily, but you can be reminded by the system to then later say, you want to remind me to set up an appointment, right? Oh. So, I don't know. It's just a level of complexity there that is kind of interesting.
And they can keep track of that. Little artificial minds can keep track of that.
Artificial minds can keep
track
of that.
I can't. Well, should we get into some of the good news of exciting tech discoveries, like ultrasound?
ultrasound, you're taking away my.
Sorry,
go ahead.
Was there
Miles?
A particular way that you wanted to introduce that?
Well, we have technology where we're able to talk to it. We have technology where we're able to touch it and interact with the touchscreens and the like. Mm-hmm. We have
the mouse. That will speak. Don't forget back the mouse.
Yes, but right now we have these screens that are flat. They don't have. One of the complaints that people had about the original iPhone was that unlike a BlackBerry, which had a physical keyboard that where you could touch mm-hmm. and feel where the individual keys were, the iPhone keyboard you had to look at because it was just flat glass.
Okay, right.
Well, people are working on that, and they're working on that
on
touch
what?
Feedback. Touch feedback.
Just touch feedback, like screen touch feedback, that kind of thing?
Well, the ability to feel where an object is. Like a BlackBerry keyboard from back in the day to touch to feel where one key ends and another one begins.
Okay.
And in technology, that's referred to as haptics.
Oh, that's haptics. Okay. Yeah.
And so what this group has done, a research paper filed, was using ultrasound to create the appearance or the sensation of a shape in open air.
Okay.
In other words, putting your hand out and feeling, in this example from the article, feeling that there is a sphere hovering over the desktop.
Whoa.
And when you put your hand there, you feel the resistance of...
In air?
Yes, of touching something that has the shape of a sphere. And you have basically the...
Whoa.
The ultrasound is causing these interference waves that at a certain barrier point,
cool.
They actually push back on you.
What? Wait, how does...
Force fields, Bonnie. Force fields.
When I think of ultrasound, I think, oh, there's my baby, right?
Yeah.
But so it can actually create force against a physical object? I thought it was about detecting a thing that was there, not making you feel
No,
thing.
It's making you feel that there's an object there.
Yes, ultrasound can be used for scanning.
That? Is that like little puffs of air?
So ultrasound can be used for scanning.
Okay.
It is kind of pressure waves. So the idea here is you take two multiple ultrasonic waves, which are something you can't hear, but they're sound. And then they have a certain frequency resonating on them. When the frequency hits a certain nodal point, the two frequencies actually cancel each other, causing the loss of signal, or amplify each other, causing the increase of signal. And you can change frequency at that point. So if you have two frequencies that interact in space, in air, and they're both air wave pressures, they can actually modify the frequency of each other, the output frequency. It's a subtraction or addition.
Okay.
Once you've done that, you've changed the air. You've changed the frequency of the sound wave. Well, low, low, low sound wave frequency, we can hear. If you ever put a hand in front of a bass, you can actually feel like a pressure wave.
Okay.
So that pressure wave actually is a bit of air that's compressed at a point. At a level where your skin can feel it, and therefore, if you have multiple ultrasonic points, you can make a node that's at the lower frequency you can feel. That's what's happening.
Okay, that blows my mind. But also, who's going deaf because we're amusing ourselves?
Yeah, you can feel this fear, but you can't ever hear again.
Right. Now, this is something that's over on air, but you can also do it closer to the surface. And one of the examples they give is putting a thin layer of oil onto a surface and then have that oil start to raise up as though they were, you know, buttons on a screen.
Using ultrasound.
So we're going to try and recreate the feel of buttons because we're recreating buttons.
Well, these are virtual buttons, though. These are buttons that can change shape.
With a BlackBerry keyboard, I'm using that as my canonical example.
Okay.
People love BlackBerries.
The Alphabet, you know, the buttons are fixed.
Yeah.
They're always there.
Okay.
Now, what we're talking about with the ultrasonic is that the buttons can change configuration at random, or not at random, but depending upon the use case that you have. So in some cases, you want to have let's look at our phone keyboards right now.
Yeah, like on my phone, there's like one keypad of the letters, and then I can push a button, and then it goes to the numeric keypad.
Right, exactly. Okay. Now imagine being able to touch the buttons depending upon the configuration that the buttons appear on the screen.
But unless you still have to look on the screen to see which button you're pushing, not just the shape of the button.
There are a lot of BlackBerry owners that never have to look down at their keyboard because they know the spacing of it. They're basically touch typing because they can feel where the buttons are and they can feel where one button ends and another one begins.
Wow. All right. And then so what are the benefits of making buttons feelable again?
That touch typing, that being so able to have typing. To know where the border is to a different item before you touch it.
And the truth is, with your phone, a touch surface phone has almost no use unless you look at it. It's very hard to use it without looking at it because you don't know where your finger
placement is. And you don't know where the boundary to one button ends. Touch targets are a total field of study on its own.
And the reason we don't have tactile representation on top of a touch screen is because it's hard to do this and we haven't had success. Yeah. So any technology that's taking that further, eventually touch surfaces will have tactile feedback. That's just one of the things that we'll want.
Yeah.
Makes a lot of sense.
Now, that said, this is just at the research stage.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, I'm assuming this is going to take a fair amount of power. So I don't know how soon it's going to show up on a handheld device that is very power limited.
Exactly. It's probably going to be on those virtual tables or whatever they're talking
about. Right. I would see that in a home environment far sooner, which means that we're going to be using more power and stuff like that. But it's that the reason why it would take some more power is the same reason why if you have a subwoofer in your house, that those take a fair amount of power to drive the sound that we want to hear.
You know, sometimes I wonder if we had portable devices that had unlimited power, what kind of things they could do. Because it's almost always the power is the
bottleneck. Yeah, changing the color on a pixel is a fixed small amount of power. Physically adjusting, like with magnets, electromagnets, to physically move a cone to move air, which is what a speaker does, mechanical energy is a huge amount of power in comparison.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have to admit my brain's going a little bit like, wow, we're like getting rid of the tactile in favor of the virtual and then trying to make it tactile and then making that more virtual. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP. I'm Bonnie Jean Primch here with Miles Elam and Lyle Troxell. And let's talk about more innovations and things for the betterment of all.
More optimism?
Yes, please.
All right. So New York City librarians, by the way, librarians rock.
Librarians.
Awesome.
Hi, Jane Gilvan.
New York City librarians will soon let patrons check out the internet. As in, you check out a book, you check out a book on tape, you check out a magazine, you check out the internet.
Can't they do that already? Because I know at my local library, you can sign up for time at a computer.
Sure. Normally, you can check in. Normally, the libraries have actually been a really great resources for internet access. So you go to the library, and as you're there, you can do that.
Okay.
Just like some materials can't actually be checked out. Normally, you can't check out the internet because what does that mean?
What does that mean?
New York City librarians will soon let patrons check out the internet. So the project is called the Library Hotspot, and basically you take home a high-access internet access point that is served via Wi-Fi service, and you put it in your house, and now you have high-speed internet access provided by the New York City Library System.
So, like, instead of going to Cruzeo for my internet, I go to the library.
You go to the library. You go get a box from the library. You take the box home. You plug it in your computer. Your computer now has high-speed internet.
That's cool.
Just like checking out a book.
Which is an interesting thing because New York City is also looking at making public Wi-Fi. They're converting their phone booths into Wi-Fi hotspots.
Yeah.
They are.
So yeah, it's awesome.
Well, aren't internet service providers getting a little upset with the library?
Well, they might be, but who cares about the internet service providers? The program called Check Out the Internet is part of an ambitious plan to get more New Yorkers online and to close the digital divide. Because the truth is, if you are financially capable of, you know, having extra funds, mm-hmm. one of the things you've got is internet access,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Though human right, I think that human right organizations have said for a long time that internet is a human right, just like water and...
Well, access to internet.
Access to internet, yeah.
And the reason for that, of course, is that living in this day and age without the internet is actually an impediment to success in life. So, try to go through your day without actually using the internet, and it becomes much more difficult. Try to get a job
without having an email address that you can check on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. It's like not having a phone number.
So the hotspots will allow 10 mobile devices like laptops, tablets, mobile phones to connect to a 4G LTE broadband. So devices powered by Sprint, it costs about $50, something like that, with a 2-year service agreement for a monthly fee of like $110. So it's mm-hmm. kind of expensive for someone that doesn't have a lot of money. But if you put that in the library system and then you check it out to people, then people have access to it for a certain period of time. They can check it back in. So you can actually start moving people in that way. Imagine you're job searching. You could check this out for the month while you're doing the job searching, have good internet all the time, be really productive, and then after that time, hopefully, you know, get to the point where you're making enough money to potentially get internet.
And yourself. If you don't return it, it's only a 37-cent late fee.
They actually say that you'll be able to check it out for long periods of time. That's part of the plan. So it's definitely one of those movements and the thing I like about this is that putting a mesh network over the entire New York Island, if you will, mm-hmm. or all of New York, mm-hmm. would be a really expensive feat. The truth is we want people that need internet access to have it. We don't want to actually necessarily provide internet access to everybody. We're going to close the digital divide. So this system allows people that have the time and energy to go to the library and check it out to get internet access, which is exactly the solution we want, which
that's
is really
exciting.
Cool. So librarians rock.
That's awesome. That reminds me of a story I saw, I think, on the Facebook stream from the Huffington Post about Seattle providing internet to the tent cities so homeless can connect and communicate and look for jobs. I haven't read the article, but we all can now. We'll link to it at geekspeak.org.
All right.
Well, that's exciting. And then there have been some studies to prove that what we thought was a good thing is, in fact, a good thing. Solid-state drives.
There was a concern, actually, for a long period of time that if you had a solid-state drive, different from a hard drive, traditional hard drive where it's these spinning platters, solid-state drive, no moving parts, that's great. But with a hard drive, many times we've come across the scenario where the hard drive stops working.
Mm-hmm.
But we're able to recover it because we were able to change out the circuit board that's on it, or
it's about
we send it
all
to
you can do,
or send it to a data recovery place where they take the platters out and they put it into another drive spindle and they replace the motor, you know, stuff like that, mm-hmm. and still get access to it. With an SSD, on the other hand, if it dies, a lot of times that's it. It's gone.
Yeah.
Your data's gone, mm-hmm. and so that made people justifiably nervous about them. Well, some folks have run SSDs, consumer-grade ones, not the ones that are made for servers, but the ones that we buy online or, mm-hmm. or in stores.
The ones that are relevant to us, the listener.
Yes.
We've tested those?
Yeah, tried testing them, and we've covered this before where they were running them for a year or so, mm-hmm. and they had gone through a petabyte of writes, and a surprising number of them actually survived it.
So a petabyte of writes, that's like writing onto the drive over and over and over.
Right. And let's do a comparison now what a petabyte is. So your SSD drive these days, a typical one is 250 gigabytes.
Okay. That's how much storage it has.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still funny. 250 gigabytes, that's a typical one. You know? The next level up from a gigabyte is a terabyte.
Okay.
And the next level up from a terabyte is a petabyte.
These are all multiples of 1,000.
Multiples of 1,000.
So a petabyte is 1 million gigabytes.
Million gigabytes.
Right.
So you're talking about writing.
Not a small chunk of change here.
Right. So this is only in test that you'd see this kind of number. I mean,
right.
Because it's so many reads and writes.
You're right.
It's crazy.
Right.
This is for two or for multiple years.
Crash test,
multiple years.
Yeah.
They've just been writing data over these drives over and over and over as
millions of times.
Yes, as
two
fast,
millions.
Yeah, as fast as the drives can go,
mm-hmm.
and it turns out that they're actually surviving.
Woohoo.
At least a couple of them are.
That's great. That's like a super sturdy piece of paper if you've got a pencil and eraser.
In fact, one that they found that had dropped off earlier in there, they actually had more than one of them. It was a Kingston. And they were going like, oh, well, this one dropped out pretty early.
And they're expecting all of them to drop out pretty quick after
the
that,
The second
right?
one, is at 2 petabytes and still going strong. So just like with hard drives, sometimes
some
you get it
error. Yeah.
But at the same time, these numbers are – okay, to put this into context, they've been
good,
running this for about – for a couple of years. They've been running this for a couple of years of just constant writes.
Yeah.
The equivalent usage for a typical user – this would be thousands of years of usage of this drive.
Right.
So we'll be all right.
We'll be okay.
So, yeah, they're doing pretty well.
That's good news. That's, yeah. I mean, the one of the concerns we've always had is that the SSD, the way it stores value, unlike a spinning media actually has an iron area magnetic domain that gets flipped magnetically, mm-hmm. and that is actually a property of the molecules. And therefore, the molecule is actually relatively large. It flips in its state, and therefore, the crystal structure is reversed. And it seems more stable to me.
A little different from hard drives, because modern hard drives have the perpendicular recording as well. So
well, they're vertical. They're more complex than that. But the general concept is magnetic domains are being flipped. In this situation, what's happening is you're actually injecting into a void, like a capacitance void, electrons. So you're putting a charge in there. And every time you read that value, you've got to write the value out right back in. And when you write the value in, you actually have to pierce. No, maybe you don't have to. To rewrite it on those, but you do have to pierce a membrane, if you will. You have to push electrons through a membrane. The concern was that membrane would fail over time, and then it would be leaky, and then you'd have a problem.
Well, it does over time,
elasticity
right.
or something.
But it looks like millions of times is okay,
right?
Which is
over
cool.
time,
that's
meaning
kind of intense.
Yeah. Yeah, what's going on is you're reading the power differential. You're seeing like, oh, this charge is at this level. It's at this level. It's at that.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing to note,
and over time, what happens is there's electrons kind of leak in and don't come back out again.
Yeah, you get problems.
And
like
so
that.
You the voltage differential becomes much more narrow until a point where you can't reliably tell is this below a certain voltage or above
right,
it.
Right. And that emerges over time of use.
Right.
So the other thing that's interesting about all these drives, when we talk about how they're working, they actually have another computer on top of them that actually runs the drive. So the drive itself has a small computer, mm-hmm. and it does things like, you know what, I've been writing more over to this area, I should write it more over to this area, and it'll move conceptual blocks around.
So it's smart about where it writes.
The actual write location is defined in software that's actually written to the drive. And so that's one of the reasons why it's really hard to recover these things. But when a computer says write to this block, the drive actually goes, yeah, no problem, write into that block. And then later when the computer says get that block, it comes back. But it's not really representational of where it is on the system.
Fun fact, same thing happens with hard drives.
Hard drives are the same.
Back in the day, folks, you wouldn't know about heads, cylinders, sectors.
I do.
Yeah.
Right. I played with those tape. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. And but the thing is, over time, operating system vendors were trying to optimize that, but it turns out the drives were lying to them. It was just the numbers that seemed convenient for getting them out, but it had no relationship whatsoever to the
really
actual physical heads, platters, and cylinders.
So where you conceptually might think, okay, you start at the top of the page, and you just keep writing until you get to the bottom of the page, what you're saying is that if the margins have more clean space,
yes.
then they might write in the margins for a little while, maybe skip over to this other margin over here, go to the middle of the page, go to the bottom of the page.
Yep.
Things aren't in the order that we think about as
that's right.
People.
And actually,
and that
all
makes
drives,
them hard to recover.
Yeah, and actually all drives also. Also, all drives data, when it says it's a certain size, it's actually larger.
Mm-hmm.
And then as spaces fail, it moves it to better spaces that it didn't tell you about.
Oh.
So there's some duration.
Secret.
Yeah,
a reserve, kind of like the reserve tank on your car's gas tank.
Yeah, exactly.
That reminds me of artificial intelligence a little bit. I know what's best to write on. Don't you worry.
Oh, yeah, that's exactly what's going on. Very smart little computer in there.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? In general, the computer is better at knowing it than we are.
Oh, yeah. We don't know nothing.
Okay.
Refer to earlier in this episode, memory is fragile.
Yeah. Hmm. Hey, I hear some of the muckety-mucks at the big companies are calling each other out.
Yeah.
Are they having a little flame war? What's going on?
I love this story. Mark Zuckerberg called out Tim Cook. Now, Mark Zuckerberg is the CEO and founder of Facebook. And Tim Cook is the CEO of Apple.
Okay.
And you don't think of them as competitors, but of course, they're big companies, so they're kind of competitors. But what's been happening recently is Tim Cook has been saying, hey, consumers that buy our products, you're our customer, and we like you. Other service providers, they're kind of calling out Google, but they're also hitting Facebook. The advertisers are their customers. This is what we say on our show when we're doing...
So Tim Cook is basically like being Ira Glass.
He's
making a pitch for, you know...
Yeah, and if you haven't heard us say it on this show before, we talk sometimes about a commercial radio station has ads. Those ads are how they make their money directly, and mm-hmm. therefore their customer is the advertiser.
Right.
And the product is the people that listen to the show.
Right.
In non-public radio like us, the customer is actually the listener, and they are the ones that potentially... donate money to us to keep us going. By the way, you can always do that at KOSP.org.
And so, now this is why all those TV shows, those bad sitcoms, make so much sense, because the advertisers don't care about making the best show possible.
Right.
It's about getting the greatest number of people who are most likely to buy their kind of products.
Yep. So what's going on at Apple is they don't let in advertisements and stuff like that into your email, or what happens in the Apple space?
I mean, Apple basically, theoretically, they're just you give them money and they give you a product, and that's how they work.
Okay.
And Mark's company, you know, Facebook, you sign up for a free account, you get a free service, and advertising is sent to you constantly, and hopefully the advertisers make enough money off of you to pay for the service. Facebook's doing pretty well. So Mark Zuckerberg says, A frustration I have is that a lot of people increasingly seem to equate advertising business model with somehow not being aligned with consumers, and he disagrees.
Oh, well, that is an interesting debate we could have for hours. This is, in fact, public radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KOSP Santa Cruz, live online at KOSP.org. And this is it for today. Find out more about this or any episode of GeekSpeak at GeekSpeak.org. Our theme music is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music at the beginning of the show. I'm Bonnie Jean Primsch with Lyle Choxel and Miles. Thank you for being here for our December 6th, 2014 episode of GeekSpeak.
Our pleasure,
always
Bonnie.
A pleasure.
Yeah, we'll be here next week, too.
All right.
See you then.